Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Hey everybody, how's it going? This is the Command Zone. I'm your host, Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
We had to do that intro three times.
Take three.
But
usually you're like a one-take wonder. What happened?
I don't know. I think it's because I have a head cold, so if I sound a little nasally, maybe that's
a little,
why.
Little Vegas hangover.
Yeah, that is. Yeah,
pre-release hangover.
I think the pre-release did it. It was the extra like button on top when I had slept for 3 hours and then decided to play Magic for five.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't in Vegas, but I did the pre-release the night before, so I also only had 3 hours of sleep.
That's right.
Yeah, episode 26.
Yes, we're halfway through a whole year. That's pretty exciting. Yeah. We took a couple breaks, of course, for holidays and stuff. But thank you to everyone that's been listening to us all the way, or those that have just jumped on. I had someone tell me that they came on because they listened to the Jason Alt show because they were Brainstorm Brewery fans. Yeah,
very cool. So, yeah, we're definitely getting, we've been getting a lot of reviews on iTunes. Thanks, everybody, for that.
Yeah.
We're going to announce the winners from this week's contest at the end of this show. So be sure to listen to the whole thing, or just skip ahead now and see if you want. You can do either one.
But we got a good episode, because today we're talking about the top 10 white cards for EDH, which is great.
This one was hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, red was, you know, red hasn't really changed a whole ton since Alpha Beta, really.
Right.
It hasn't evolved a ton. It's pretty much still aggro.
Wait, you calling us...
No, I'm just saying, like, what red's identity has been the same since the beginning. So it doesn't have like this wide array of stuff that it can do. It's pretty much like damage to your face and chaotic stuff.
Yeah, and being very aggressive in general.
But white has been all over the map over the years, so there's just so many like directions to go, and it's really hard to rank them.
Yeah, and there are so many angels. You have to find the best ones.
There's just so many creatures that do so many disparate things that it's like, I don't know, is this ability better than this one? It's tough because it depends on the deck. Anyway, I found this one really tough. In artifacts, we did was, you'd think that'd be hard, but it wasn't.
That wasn't that bad, yeah.
Because with artifacts, you basically have to find, like, you're thinking, like, oh, artifacts usually do something that at least one of the colors can do. They just do it sort of slightly less efficient. So you're like, well, what's the best artifact that draws cards? What's the best artifact that does ramp? It ends up being not that difficult. But again, white, I had like 40 cards on my list to begin with.
My list was gigantic.
Yeah, and I'm like, how do I narrow this down?
That's why my honorable mentions list is so big. Because I was like, oh, this is an honorable
mention. Yeah, I noticed you cheated a lot. I was like, well, my honorable mention list is still 4 cards. So yeah,
that's true.
Our lists are very different this time.
Yeah, I'm excited. We have a couple of shared... Actually, we've got some good stuff in there.
We have some shared ones, but I'd say not as many as the last two.
Oh, yeah, definitely not. But before we get into all of that, we are going to talk a little bit about the pre-release that we did yesterday, and we also have a couple of corrections for last week's episode. Thank you guys for tweeting at us, by the way, and telling us where we slipped up, because
the one thing you learn when you do a podcast is like you make mistakes because you're just talking off the cuff, and then you know you learn, oh, that's not actually true, or whoops, I said that wrong.
I should have read that card twice.
Yeah. So, well, the first correction is Dagatar, who, if you will,
the adamant. I played him at the pre-release, and he was great. Oh my gosh,
he's very good in limited.
Yeah.
So the we didn't really make a mistake, but we did fail to mention something. Dagatar, I'm going to read him again just so that everybody is on the same page. He's 3 and a white for a 0/0 legendary creature with vigilance. Dagatar the Adamant enters the battlefield with 4/1/1 counters on it. So he's a 4/4 to start. And then you can pay 1 and hybrid Golgari twice, so 3 mana total, so 1 black-green. And then when you pay that, you can move a 1/1 counter from target creature onto a second target creature. So what we failed to mention and didn't really realize, honestly, at the time was that you can just steal counters from your opponents.
Yeah.
So,
which is so important in limited, for sure.
In limited, in this limited format, especially because there's Bolster, there's Outlast, there's all the stuff that puts 1/1 counters. And I saw you, like a dude, put out an Abzan Ascendancy, put 1/1 counters on all the stuff. And
They were all gone by the time.
I looked at the table, he had 1/1 counters on 4 guys. Yeah. And then I went back to my game and looked over again, and he had no counters on his same guys. Yeah. He just had them all. So that's pretty awesome and limited. I think we were still correct in that Dagatar doesn't feel super powerful in EDH. Because
now, if you're playing against a bunch of players that love +1/+1 counters,
if they're playing in a Marchesa deck or an Animar deck, then
sure, yeah, you can steal from them.
It's 3 mana. Yeah. I think even in like those decks, it'll be hard to keep up. They're still going to be able to keep some of their counters.
Well, they're also just better cards to put 1/1 counters where you want them. And the upside of stealing someone else's +1/+1 counter is probably not going to be as good as just playing a better card.
And just a lot of games, there just won't be any 1-1 counters on anything in the game. I mean, that's very specific, just two types of decks, really.
Yeah, and Daggerjar dies to a lot of board wipes, whereas an enchantment that does the same thing, for instance, might not, you know, be as... It is a little more resilient, so there's just other options. But yeah, I think it's still fun. It could be a fun commander, it just... to really build around him and be able to swap stuff out at instant speed and, you know, really do... maybe
I don't see
it
being, I still don't see it being super powerful. But anyway, I did want to make that correction because we hadn't mentioned it. And the other thing, which was kind of a bigger one, is that although it doesn't actually apply because I don't think there's a legendary creature that has dash, but we had talked about how if you paid the dash cost on something, you could get around the commander tax.
Oh, it's just the dragon.
Oh, there's a legendary Derevi. Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah, we thought that the dash cost was kind of like Derevi's. You can put them in from the command zone from wherever
and skip
play
the
and
command
skip
tax.
Yeah, you're
the
actually
commander tax.
It's an alternate casting cost, so you're still going to pay the extra if that commander dies or is put back into the command zone.
Yeah, because you're still casting it even if you're paying the dash cost.
Mm-hmm.
So if the commander had died, then you would still have to pay the extra mana on top of the dash cost.
However, if you do dash it out and then it goes back to your hand, then the cost goes back to normal because you're casting it from your hand and not from the command zone.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Okay. So those are, we apologize.
Corrections.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about our criteria a little bit. I mean, we don't have necessarily the same criteria. In fact, you were recently on the Masters of Modern podcast, and Ben and Alex and you a little bit were doing the...
very little. I contribute very little to those podcasts, but I like hearing... It helps. It makes me feel like, oh, now I know more about Magic.
Yeah, now I know more about Modern.
Yeah.
So they were doing their top 10 artifacts in Modern.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was really interesting because Ben and Alex had an interesting dynamic that I think sort of showcased why these sort of discussions kind of... are interesting and they can escalate and people get really passionate about it.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of ways to look at like what's the best quote unquote card or what's a better card quote unquote. And
the big one was like Darksteel Citadel versus Spellskite.
Darksteel Citadel versus Spellskite. And Alex was saying Darksteel Citadel and Ben was saying Spellskite. And it's an interesting argument. And basically their two philosophies were just different. Like Alex was basically when he was ranking his artifacts, he was thinking of what's this artifact's most powerful, when it's at its most powerful, how powerful is it?
Yeah.
And Ben's take was kind of more like, what is this artifact at its average in most scenarios?
Yeah.
How powerful is that? Which means that Darksteel Citadel is, when it's at its average, is not that great.
It's just a colorless land.
Yeah. But when it's its most powerful, when it's in an affinity deck, when it's when you have Insol Artifact in your deck, you know, then it's one of the most powerful cards in that deck.
Yeah.
And so that's just a philosophical difference that I think, you know, depending on which side you're on, it's you're going to fight for different cards. You're going to think different cards are more powerful.
I still think Spellskite's better.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're both sort of more on the Ben side of that argument.
I think it might be because of EDH as well, because there's no... I mean, you can make an affinity deck in Commander, but I feel like
you can make an awesome,
I feel like Spellskite just fits in every... You can put a Spellskite in every single
deck. See, again, now you're on the side of the argument of Ben's, which is like, yeah, that is more useful in more decks, therefore I rank it as more powerful.
Yep.
But I can see Alex's side, which is like, oh, yeah, but... when this card is powerful, it's way more powerful than Spellskite.
I mean, when you can play it as like a 4-of and hit Metalcraft really early because of those artifact lands, and that's super powerful.
But I think philosophically we're mostly the same, which is like we like the I want the card to be ranked on what it is in an average scenario, not in the best case scenario.
And that is one of our criteria. So the first one that we usually talk about is mana cost. So if it's super high up there or it's very prohibitive, like it's like got 5 white mana symbols in there, then
It doesn't mean it can't be on the list. It just means it's
a take against it.
Yeah.
And then the other one, of course, is how useful is it in a multitude of decks and colors.
Right. So if it's a very narrow strategy, that doesn't mean it can't be on the list. It just means that it sort of gets knocked down a peg or two.
Yeah. Quadrant theory, which is something that we learned from Limited Resources. I'll go over that really quickly. Quadrant theory is basically how well a card performs in 4 stages of the game. In development, when you're at board parity, you guys are sort of just looking, staring at each other, nothing's happening. When you're losing, which I think is the most important, and when you're winning.
Yeah, and we really went into this in our episode with Marshall Sutcliffe from Limited Resources. He came on the show and really and really broke down the quadrant theory. And it's a very interesting way to just look at card evaluation.
Yeah.
So I think no matter, even if you're not ranking cards like we are, that's a good way to sort of figure out, you know, is a card good in your deck is to look at the Quadrant Theory. So that's episode 9 also, if you haven't listened to it.
Yeah, we talk about Animar. And I think a big novice mistake in Commander is that you put too many cards that are good when you're winning.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, great. Yeah, overkill, overkill, overkill. Treasure Hunt Behemoth all the time.
Well, it's like we were talking about, too. There's something called best-case scenario mentality. That's also Marshall has talked about a lot on his show. And it's just like thinking of the card only when, you know, it's in its best case. But really, you want to think of a card also when it's in its worst case.
Yeah.
So, because often you're going to draw the card and it's, you know, you're not going to have your commander out and you're not going to have six cards in your hand and you're not going to have all the land you want and you're not going to have the other piece of the combo. Then how good is that card?
Yeah, by itself.
Yeah, exactly. So that's something to think about. And the last one is sort of, does the card either enable or fight strategies which are prevalent in EDH? So what are prevalent EDH strategies? You know, token strategies, Voltron strategies, lots of board wipes. You know, those are just things that are very prevalent. You know, lots of card draw, lots of mana ramp. Those are the things that, you know, most EDH decks do, or you're going to see those things often. And so if you're going to come up against something often, then it's more important that you have either something to fight it or something that does that or enables that. So that's sort of the criteria we use. All right.
Well, let's get into it.
You want to start with number 10?
Yeah.
All right. You go first.
My number 10 is a little card called Mentor of the Meek.
Mentor of the Meek.
So Mentor of the Meek is a... it's like card draw for white. White doesn't have too much card draw.
White's actually maybe the worst color at card draw.
Yeah, and Mentor of the Meek, I think, is one of the better cards for that. It is a little limited. I'll read it. So it's 2 and a white for a 2/2 creature human soldier. Whenever another creature with power 2 or less enters the battlefield under your control, you may pay 1 mana. If you do, draw a card.
So white is also sort of the king of the small creatures.
Right.
So white weenies. Yeah, white weenies been around since alpha. So this sort of synergizes well with itself in that white's going to often have a lot of smaller creatures, utility creatures. And then when you play them, you pay 1 extra mana and you draw cards. You know, you draw an extra card.
Yeah. So this doesn't work terribly well if you just have huge creatures in your deck, obviously.
It's not necessarily for every deck, but it is very powerful in the decks.
Yeah. And I think card draws really is something that white needs in a shell. So that's why I have Mentor of the Meek up there. I like it.
I think one of the things too,
it also comes out very early.
Yeah, it comes out early. I think also one of white's, you know, white's color pie is pretty wide, but one of the things it's really good at is token generating.
Mm-hmm.
And notice that Mentor for the Meek doesn't say non-token creatures.
Yes,
so
that's very important.
When you play a card that puts even just Raise the Alarm, which is a crappy card, but just for an example, it's 2 mana and you get 2/1/1 creatures out of it. Well, those can each trigger Mentor for the Meek.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you make tokens, you can draw cards. And white has a lot of just pay 3 mana, make a token. Well, that means pay 4 mana, make a token, draw a card.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so
that's pretty good.
That's why I think Mentor for the Meek, it's a very good card. Ironically, I don't have it on my list, and here I am just talking good about it. But
it's your honorable mention. You can say I made it there, right?
Okay, so my number 10 is Blind Obedience.
Ooh la la.
We talked about this before in the Over for Performers episode. It's 1 and a white for an enchantment. It has extort. That's not important, so I'm not going to read it. What it says is artifacts and creatures your opponents control enter the battlefield tapped.
Ugh.
It feels, you know, there's a few other cards, Kismet, there's a few others. Mm-hmm. Some affect you also, some don't. But this is sort of the best one, I think, because it's the cheapest. And it has extort on top of it, which extort is useful. It's just not why the card's good.
Yeah.
Extort allows you, anytime you cast a spell, you can pay a white or a black, and everybody loses a life and you gain a life.
Yeah, you can do it one time per spell.
Yeah, which is not why the card's good. Making all your opponent's stuff, artifacts and creatures, come into play tapped, it just slows them down, gives you time to react to what they're doing.
It time-walks them. Like
sometimes.
The whole term, yeah. Because if they have a soul ring, it's like, oh, it comes into play tapped.
Yep.
So now that ramp I had to make something huge.
At least for that turn. Yeah, exactly. But also token strategies that just put out 20 guys and try to attack you with it.
Right.
You know, or stuff like Infinite Combos, Kiki Jiki, Pestermite, you know, Splinter Twin, Midnight Guard, crap like that. That if all the creatures they're making come into play tapped, that doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Just Voltron strategies. How often is a Voltron strategy play my general, Swiftfoot Boots, swing, kill you.
Yeah.
That happens a lot, especially later on in games where they're they got their 4 equipment out and they're got, you know, 2 exalted dudes. And it's well, as soon as he plays his commander, somebody's dead, you know? And it's nope, because it comes into play tapped.
Yeah.
So that just stops all the haste effects. And haste is a huge part of EDH. So, this is a really It's an innocuous card, but...
Well, the fact that it costs two is also incredible, because it comes out in turn two, and it's affecting the board for the rest of the game. Yeah, or as long as it doesn't get removed. And it's also not that terrible that people want to get rid of it immediately, because it's just like, all right, fine, one turn.
That's actually a really good point.
Because if it stayed tapped, then people would hate
and I think,
you.
You know, our criteria didn't list this, but this time I was thinking about, because white has a lot of cards that are pretty mean.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think another thing that has to be factored into the equation of how good the card is in EDH specifically, is how much hate does it cause among the table? Because there's some very good cards, but man, as soon as you play it, everyone wants to kill you. And that should count. That should knock the card down a little bit. Yeah. Blind Obedience does stuff, but it doesn't actually make people that angry.
Yeah.
It's just like, ah, that's a little annoying.
Yeah, unless you start extorting everything, then I'm like, why are you doing that?
But even then, it's like one damage at a time. It doesn't...
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, my number nine is a Planeswalker. The only Planeswalker I have on this list, actually. And it also sort of falls into the white weenie category, but it is my favorite Elspeth. It's Sun's Champion. She's 4/2 white for a 4 loyalty Planeswalker with 3 great abilities. The first one is put 3 1/1 white soldier creatures tokens onto the battlefield for her +1. Now, if you guys know the other Elspeth, I believe it was Elspeth Tyrell did the same thing for -2. So she comes down on the board, she immediately protects herself, and that's one of the most important things with a Planeswalker. Her -3 is destroy all creatures of power 4 or greater. So if you're playing a white weenie strategy, then Elspeth is also very powerful in that regard, because your guys usually will not get affected by her board wipe. Do many other Planeswalkers even have board wipes?
Elspeth actually does on some of her other incarnations.
Right, incarnations.
Ugin, we know, does.
Right,
there's a few others, too.
And then her -7, which you probably won't get to, is you get an emblem with creatures you control get +2/+2 and have flying. So this is sort of still in the realm of the white weenie, because I just think that's one of the best ways to really take advantage of white's cards is by playing to their strengths, which
She's amazing with Mentor for the Meek.
Right? You do a +1, pay 3 mana, you get 3 cards.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. That's great. So I really like Elspeth. She's one of my favorite Planeswalkers. And I think really the most important thing for this is that she can put out blockers for herself.
You know, it's interesting because something I debated and was on my list for a long time and eventually got knocked off the list was actually Elspeth Knight Errant.
Oh, right.
Which is very similar. Her +1 puts only 1 white soldier creature token onto the battlefield. She has another +1, which is target creature gets +3/+3 and gains flying. And then I won't even talk about her ultimate because that's not why I had her on the list. But the reason I had her a little above Sun's Champion, because they were both neck and neck. And
a bit cheaper.
A bit cheaper. She's 2/2 white. And also, I thought her +1 worked really well in Voltron strategies.
Oh, right, because she has 2+1s, and you can,
Yeah, well, and it's like +3/+3 and flying
can
be big if you're also giving the creature double strike or something like that, which a lot of Voltron strategies
do. This Elspeth with Rafiq is just nuts.
Broken. I mean, you can literally I've got Elspeth out, play Rafiq. It's pretty easy to kill somebody right there.
Yeah, you can hit for at least 16 commander.
Yeah, you only need one more equipment maybe to put you into 21 instant death. So anyway, interesting. I like both of them. Sun's Champion, super powerful. I mean, just making 3 guys every turn is like...
Yeah, I mean, if you let that get out of control, then it's... I don't think there's much more efficient token generation than that. That you can guarantee every turn. I mean, sometimes, I mean, like,
And if you have doubling season, parallel lives, I mean, you're going to be in a token dedicated token deck a lot.
I think Mykoloth is like the closest in terms of being able to pump out a ton of dudes. But yeah, I really
and
like that.
And she has the board wipe on her, which is like, you know, we know board wipes in EDH is super, super powerful. And it's actually like a potential one sided board wipe because destroy all creatures with power 4 or greater. That means, you know, if you build your deck in a way that doesn't hit you, then all of a sudden you're in like, in Garruk's Wake territory, you know, or Cyclonic Rift territory.
Yeah, everyone else keeps their weenies, which aren't going to be able to swing in and kill her anyway, and you get rid of the most significant creatures on the board, which oftentimes is, like, everyone's general.
So, yeah.
Heck, I'll take it.
My number 9 is a card we've talked about many times. It's Sarah Ascendant.
Oh, boy.
Sarah Ascendant is a super powerful EDH card. It's 1 white.
It used to be a terrible card, right?
Yeah, it was a very bad card until EDH.
Could build around it in standard or whatever to
but
try
it was
get
a bad
life.
Idea.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 1 white for a 1/1 with lifelink.
Boo.
But it has additional text.
Oh.
As long as you have 30 or more life, Sarah Ascendant gets +5/+5 and has flying. So in EDH, it's the most efficient creature of all time.
Yeah.
It's a 1 white for a 6/6 flying lifelinker.
On turn one.
Yeah.
That's busted.
Even on turn 3, 4, it's very, very good because you play it for 1 white mana. And
no one's going to be able to trump that.
You do something else. You know, you put a Sword of Light and Shadow on it or something, you know. Like, it's very, very, very powerful. But really, the games where you played on turn one, like, somebody's just dead. Somebody at the table. Yeah. Like, EDH decks aren't as fast as other formats, like, most of the time. You know, unless somebody has, like, a Path to Exile in hand right now.
Right.
Yeah, it's
you get her out, and then if you throw down an equipment on her, too, and it gets very brutal.
We played a game against our friend Matt Arnold once, and it was 3-player, and he got Sarah Ascendant out turn one. He actually Soul Ring turn two, got a Sword of Light and a Shadow, and literally killed both of us before we could do much. Yeah, it was crazy.
I was like, I play a mana dork.
Yeah, and then you're like, and I'm dead. Her. And then I was like, I have 2 more turns. Oh, God.
Yeah, Matt had like 87 life or something ridiculous by the end. Yeah, that was great.
So, very powerful card. I noticed it's actually a little higher on your list.
Yeah, it is, just because I don't have as many as... I have like 3 white decks, and I'd love to have... I have 1 Sarah Ascendant, so maybe that's why I put it just a little bit higher.
I actually only have Sarah Ascendant in 1 deck.
Oh, really?
I own a couple of them, but yeah, I only have it in 1. But it's just... It's so powerful. Maybe. Yeah, I'll just give it to you if you want.
All right. Oh, thanks, man. That's that Command Zone spirit, guys. We have these Google Docs, by the way, that are just giant lists of cards that we've just lent each other and just given to each other.
But I never even look at it.
I'm just like, just whatever. You can have it.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. If I really need that card, I'll send you a text.
Yeah, exactly. All right. To number 8. I'm going to go first this time.
Sure.
Number 8, I have Elesh Norn. Oh. Grand Cenobite. You know, it's funny. A dude just played this on me last night at the pre-release we were playing.
Oh, right. His Carador deck?
Yeah.
It is the deck to play this card, by the way. That deck of all the decks plays Elesh Norn.
I actually think Elesh Norn belongs in a lot of white decks.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Weenie strategy.
Yeah, let me read her really quick. She's expensive. Well, she's expensive money-wise, but she's also expensive mana-wise. She's 5/2 white for a legendary creature, a 4/7, which is weird. She has vigilance, because with these other abilities, she wasn't powerful enough to give her vigilance. It says, other creatures you control get +2/+2.
If you just stop there, I'd be down.
That's pretty good. 4/7 vigilance that gives all your creatures +2/+2.
Yeah.
But she's got more. This is the kicker. Creatures your opponents control get -2/-2.
Oh, my gosh.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
power and toughness swing between your creatures and theirs, plus it just outright kills
a ton. Yeah.
So often you drop Elesh Norn and it's basically a board wipe for everybody else.
Well, not just that, it's a board wipe for like everyone's really useful creatures.
Yeah. And all your creatures just get huge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I there's very few games where you see Elesh Norn come down and it doesn't just immediately like drastically affect the board to the point where like somebody's basically dead. Because you usually drop it and then you swing with your dudes and all of a sudden they lost all their guys.
Yeah.
It's a pretty, you know, this card is very, very powerful.
She's also got the coolest hat of all time.
I know she's not on your list at all.
You know what? I think it's a mistake. I think I should have put her on there.
It's hard, though. I'm looking at all your cards, and I'm like, well, I should have put those on there.
Yeah. it's funny, because when we first started talking about this list, I was like, well, Elesh Norn and Sarah Sennin have to be on there, and Elesh Norn didn't make my list at all.
Dude, you better watch out. She's got that scary hat, and she's coming after you.
I know. She is coming after me.
Scary headpiece, I suppose.
You know, I feel like she's blind. She's got that hat on. She can't see.
She doesn't have to see you. She just gives everybody in her area -2/-2.
Yeah. Maybe she just has a really good sense of smell.
Maybe you're bigger than a 2/2 creature, Jimmy, and you're okay.
Oh, thank God. I hope I'm like...
I said maybe.
You know what? I'll be a 1/3. How about that? I'll barely survive.
I like your high opinion of yourself.
I mean, I've got a head cold right now. I'm definitely not more than a 1. All right, my number 8, which I think is higher up on your list, and maybe it does deserve a higher spot, is Land Tax. Aside from having the worst art of all time...
Come on, it's awesome. It's the Sheriff of Nottingham or something.
Yeah, how does he have 2 rings on his middle finger? How does that even work? Oh, okay, anyway. The Oracle Text, because this is an older card, it's a 1 white mana for an enchantment. And at the beginning of your upkeep, if an opponent controls more lands than you, you may search your library up to 3 basic land cards, reveal them, and put them into your hand. If you do, shuffle your library.
So it's an opponent.
An opponent. Anyone on the table.
So if one person on the table has more lands than you.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a trick with land tax is you just don't play a land one turn.
Yeah,
just
this
to
is
turn
the card.
It on.
You just wait. You're like, all right, land tax turn one. And then you like have one round go by. I'm like, great. Now I never have to worry about lands for the rest of the game.
Yeah, I'm going to draw as many lands as
It's pretty... I mean, this is... It's so powerful. Because if someone like plays an explore or exploration, you're like, oh, sweet. Land tax is going to go to town.
Yep.
It drastically thins your deck. This is actually, I think, significant. If every turn you're taking three extra cards out of your deck.
Yeah. And
you're going to be drawing gas a lot.
It is drawing cards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the thing. White doesn't draw cards. It is drawing cards. Now, it's not drawing spells, but
yeah,
those are still cards. I mean, you know.
Yeah. You also have to watch out if you're if you don't have any basic lands in your deck. Like, you couldn't play this in your five-color deck.
No, yeah, you can't. You can't play it in necessarily every deck, but most decks will have some basic lands.
But the thing is, for one white mana, even if you just trigger this twice, it's totally worth
it. Six cards.
You're
going to... You guarantee that you have the right mana and you have enough mana for the game. It's super powerful. I have it actually really high up. I have it as my number three.
I might have to reconsider. I might need to move up a little bit. Because this, now that I'm looking at this card, maybe the art threw me off.
It's got horrible art. Well, there is downsides to the card, though.
Yeah.
If you draw it on turn six or seven, it's probably not going to do a lot for you at that point. You know, but even then, you're going to still, often in EDH, you want to get to your 10th, 11th, 12th land drop.
Yeah, it's true.
But, you know, there will be times in the game where, drawing land doesn't... And this is just drawing you a lot of land.
Yeah, and sometimes you do turn it off as well.
Yeah, that's
true. And also, other people can force you to turn it off by them not playing a land.
That's true. If you're playing against somebody who's got...
it out.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody who's got ways or uses for getting rid of their own land, they can get below you and then... Yeah. So, it's not always awesome, but when it's... But at its average, it's very powerful.
Yeah, it is. It is very powerful. I definitely am a big fan of land tax.
Okay, number seven. Well, let's let you go because
my number seven is Sarah Ascendant.
Sarah Ascendant.
So good.
Yeah,
we already talked about it, of course. So let's go to your number seven.
My number seven is Enlightened Tutor.
Ah, now this is a card. White has a couple of tutors, and we always talk about tutors because they are incredibly powerful.
Yeah,
they are essentially a card in your deck that you want at any time. It's like a double of any card that it qualifies for.
An Enlightened Tutor, it is card disadvantage. Well, let me read it. It's one white for an instant. It says, search your library for an artifact or enchantment, important that it's both, and reveal that card. Shuffle your library, then put that card on top of it. So it is card disadvantage because you use a card, but then you still have to
draw
the card that you found. But in EDH, like... You built your deck with a lot of card draw, right? Like, we've been talking about that for like 25 episodes, so I hope you did. So usually being down a card is not too important. You have other cards that
and
make
at
up
instant
for
speed, you're going to do it at the
you
end
do
step
it at the
before
end
your
step,
turn. Yeah.
And then, or you say, I would do this during the end step, but I'm going to save time.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it now.
We
do that all the time. But like, tutors, extremely powerful, and white is the sort of the enchantment color. Like, that, they're the best at enchantments. They have a lot of enchantments that do crazy stuff. Now, that's debatable, but I would say...
I think you're right in that case, because white also has a lot of enchantment matters cards. Like, Idyllic Tutor is just an enchantment.
A lot of
tutor.
Stuff that gets specifically enchantments back from the graveyard. Mm-hmm. The fact that this says artifact also, though, is really what put it up. Like, Idyllic Tutor, there's a few others... They don't get both.
Mm-hmm.
So getting an artifact, and there's so many powerful artifacts, especially if you're in white. Like, let's say you're in mono white. Well, you might need card draw. Well, your card draw is going to be like Mind's Eye.
Yeah.
Or an artifact.
Or a Scroll Rack or something.
Yeah, so you're going to need to go get that. So it's
or even just getting a Soul Ring with this is perfectly acceptable.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Or go getting a piece of your combo or something that, you know, or an equipment, or there's a million things you might want to go get. This card is very, very, it's actually, I think it's dropped in price recently. I'm not sure why, but I feel
it's so good.
Yeah. I recently just bought like five or six of them because I was like, well, every white deck I have puts this in.
Yeah. Being able to fetch an enchantment too is great because there are so many enchantments that are responses in my deck to other decks. Like Aura Shards is a card I play a lot of because if you don't have something to get rid of other stuff, then, you know, you're going to be big trouble. So,
and especially like, you wouldn't necessarily want a bunch of cards that do what Aura Shards does because sometimes you don't need it.
Yeah.
But when you do need it, you really need it.
Really,
so what Enlightened
it,
Tutor allows you to do is be like, oh, I have Aura Shards, I got Blind Obedience, I've got, you know, Ghostly Prison, and I only need one of those.
Yeah.
Well, Enlightened Tutor lets you go find the one you need when you need it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not to mention being just one mana means you can hold open the mana for this at any time.
Very easily.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to number six. We have the exact same number six.
Oh, look at that.
Look at that.
I guess That is empirical evidence. That's scientific that this is the number six most powerful white card in EDH. Just,
of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
See, all yeah. time. it would be the one and only Big Mama, Avacyn, Angel of Hope.
Big Mama.
Big Mama.
Can I call her? I'm just calling her Big Mama from now on.
Big Mama, Angel of Hope.
Does she make chicken and waffles?
No, but she, well, I guess she does, but you can't eat them because they're indestructible.
That was because if anybody's been to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles in LA, yep. Big Mama is.
Big Mama, yeah.
She's a staple.
She's also a Big Mama because she costs 8 converted mana cost, which is 5 and 3 white. So
it's a lot, but
it's prohibitive if you're not a strongly white deck. But by the time you're able to cast this, you should have the white mana for it.
Just one Gilded Lotus, you're good.
Yeah, exactly. Or one Kalia.
There you go.
So Avacyn, Angel of Hope, 8 mana total, 5 and 3 white. She has flying and vigilance, and essentially she has indestructible because other permanents you control have indestructible, and she's an 8/8.
Well, Avacyn and other permanents yeah. you control have indestructible.
So she's yeah. indestructible.
And she's an 8/8 flyer with vigilance.
Yeah, that's pretty...
It's incredible. It's incredible. For one, she's an 8/8 flyer with vigilance.
Yeah.
So that's just crazy powerful right there. But yeah. making all your stuff indestructible?
Yeah, that's insane.
She's one of those cards, she hits the table and everybody just looks around at everybody else like, you got something for that?
You got something for that?
What do you got?
Yeah. I mean, you're like, I got a board wipe. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, you need exile, target, whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, something
crazy. Or a talk effect or something, yeah.
And she really enables you to play creature decks. You know, there's mm-hmm. Creature decks are just hard to play in EDH because there's so many board wipes that it's just yeah. hard. But, you know, you need a bunch of angels of Avacyns and stuff like that to sort of, like, make yourself immune to the board wipes.
Yeah. Not to mention this secures your board. Like, you can... Now, if you want to start attacking, like, go for it. You're not going to lose anybody. Like, people are going to be forced to make blocks. And even if they make blocks that are good for them, they're still probably going to take damage and your creatures aren't going anywhere.
I mean, she's good. I even have her in, like, my Flicker deck.
Oh, nice. So you can save her if someone tries to...
I just want my stuff to not be able to be removed.
Right.
You know? And board wipes still hurt the Flicker deck, because usually, you know, they board wipe and you flicker out two things.
But you still lose a bunch.
You might have 5 things. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But Avacyn makes it very, very hard. And then if they manage to try and get rid of her, you can flicker her.
Right.
And, you know, she's really powerful in a lot of situations, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Avacyn, I think she speaks for herself. Big Mama. Definitely the best card to put in a Kalia deck, because if Kalia swings and Avacyn comes out, it's...
Oh, man. You just win.
You just win, yeah.
It's the worst.
You're doing 10 damage off that swing alone. And she. But the funny thing with Kalia is that Avacyn actually comes in tapped when you play her with Kalia, because that's
right.
Kalia's
tapped
text.
Tapped and attacking.
Yeah, it's the only time she's ever going to get tapped, essentially.
Okay, on to number 5. For number 5, I have Humility.
Nice.
Humility is an enchantment. Costs 2 and 2 white. It says, all creatures lose all abilities and have base power and toughness 1/1.
Oh, that is humility indeed.
This is in a lot of ways better than a board wipe.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wipe the board and so many decks just have a way to, like, oh, get my stuff out of my graveyard.
Yeah.
Or it sends the generals, the commanders, to the command zone because you mm-hmm. killed them. This doesn't do that. Those things just turn into 1/1s. They can't put them in the command zone. They don't get to get them back out of their graveyard.
Yeah, they're just sitting there as 1/1s.
And if you board wipe, they go, okay, it's, of course, it kind of sucks, but then they play their next creature, and it's still what it is, but not with humility out. You play your creature, and it's a 1/1. You play Gaddock Teague. He doesn't do anything. He's a 1/1. He doesn't stop everything that he's supposed to stop. You play, you know, Avacyn. She doesn't have any text. Mm-hmm. She's... just a 1/1 creature.
Unless someone removes this enchantment, everything is a 1/1. And if you're playing a white weenie deck and you have, like, Marshall's Anthem or things that buff your creatures, then you are going to be benefiting off of this more than everyone else, because you're already putting out, like, 1/1 tokens or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So your cards don't have abilities text, mm-hmm. and they're not 2/2s or 3/3s or 8/8s.
But they do keep their creature types.
Yep.
And I believe they keep their colors.
Yeah.
So if you're playing a white weenies deck and you're a soldier tribal deck, then you're still in business.
Yep. So this, and I put this in a lot of decks that just don't have a lot of creatures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Nekusar deck.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Now, this
yeah.
would turn Nekusar himself into a 1/1 with no abilities, but.
But there's so many other things.
Underworld
you're doing.
Dream still works.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of things, like, there's still a lot of ways to kill them that aren't creature based.
The Howling Mine is still howling.
Yeah. Howling Mine is still howling. Yeah. This is a super powerful card. It just kills creature decks, it just shuts down creature decks.
I'm a big...
Except for token decks.
Yeah.
If you play this,
but even then, if the token decks are based around having other creatures being the guys that buff them.
Like Prosh, it would hurt a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Although his coat of arms still is pretty good.
Oh, right. Yeah, so it's an enchantment that kills all the creatures. So if you're enchantment heavy or artifact heavy, then you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. My number five is Oblation.
Oh, yeah.
It's a 2 and a white for an instant, and it is white's version of Chaos Warp. The owner of target non-land permanent shuffles it into his or her library, then draws 2 cards. So they get whoever loses the permanent still gets a benefit by drawing 2 cards, but you can essentially tuck a commander this way. You can get rid of the most problematic thing. There is a chance that they'll draw it again.
Super small chance.
There also is a chance that you cast this on your own thing, so you can just draw 2 cards for 3, which is like a divination. Yep. You lose, like, I don't know, like a token or something. Mm-hmm. So it's just very utility. It's instant speed. It's something that decks often need to deal with big threats.
And there's, like we've often said, there's so many decks where if their commander is tucked into their library, that deck just is doing nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you have a Jaleva deck.
Oh, God.
That deck just can't function without its commander.
Yeah, or Narset or that, yeah.
So,
or if someone plays Humility on you, you got to get rid of it. Oblation.
Yeah, true. Yeah, because it gets rid of any non-land permanent. So, yeah, super, super powerful. Yeah, this is a EDH staple. Ironically, I don't have it on my list again. But
it's on your honorable mentions, right? It's always on, you know, if it's on the list, it's on the honorable mentions.
It was on the list of stuff I wanted to put on there, but I only had 10 slots, so... All right. You want to do your number four?
Yes. My number four is the...
It's funny. I put these same 2 cards together also.
Yeah, but they're very similar. They essentially do the same thing in
they're
a lot of ways.
They're the best single target removal spells in the history of the game.
It would be Swords to Plowshares or Plowshares. I have no idea how to say it. And
Swords to Plowshares.
Plowshares. What does that even mean?
In the old days, they would call the peasants to war, right?
Uh-huh.
Like during the Crusadish, Dark Ages times.
Right.
And they would literally be not trained fighters, and they would just give them swords, and then they would go out and fight. And then after the battle, and in the old days, you know, the battles were like a day or a couple days, and then they would go back to
farmers,
and so they'd put down their swords and pick up their plowshares. And
Swords to Plowshares.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So
little history lesson.
Yeah, that was nice.
That was not exactly. I know history buffs out there are like, that's not what the art is. Yeah, I was just truncating it for the...
Yeah,
you know.
That makes the art, the newer art from Conspiracy for Swords of Plowshares that much more cool.
Come on, the original art is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I like the original art
drawn
too, because the guy is like, he's like ready to farm again. He's like, oh boy, back, lost an arm, but I'm ready to farm.
Wow, that was a good poem.
Yeah, it rhymes.
Lost an arm, but I'm ready to farm.
Magic the Gathering.
I don't know why that magic. Okay, anyway, let's read it.
Yeah, Swords of Plowshares and Path to Exile are both 1 mana for an instant that starts with the text exile target creature. Now, in Swords to Plowshares case, it says its controller gains life equals to its power, so there is a upside for that, but life gain, as we've talked about, is not particularly relevant in EDH for the most part. And
I mean, if you want to kill a creature like an Avacyn, you don't care if they gain 8 life.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's just like,
you're like,
I gotta, that creature's just gotta go. Exile a creature.
Exile, yeah. That's
why you
thing
can get Avacyn.
Yeah, and yeah, if these were just straight kill spells, they wouldn't make the list. Like, if we did a top 10 black list, I don't think, you know, like a Doomblade would make that list.
Right.
Because these exile creatures, it's that much more significant.
And they're only 1 mana, which is a huge thing.
And Path to Exile, I think, is that a Johnny getting exiled?
It does look like a Johnny.
Poor Johnny. Or one of his friends.
It's probably just his, like, younger nephew. Pretty sure it is.
That sounds even more sad, because Johnny's like, I lost my nephew.
Johnny's, like, off screen right now going, no!
Or he's like, you have done the clan wrong, and he exiles his nephew.
He is white.
Yeah.
So
on the other side of Path to Exile, it says, exile targeted creature, and its controller may search his or her library for a basic land card and put that card on the battlefield tapped, then shuffle their library.
So you ramp them by one.
You ramp them. But again, like, if it's like, kill Avacyn, give them a land, I'd be like, yep, all day.
All day.
All day,
all
yeah.
Day. Also, if it's Avacyn, they already have 8 mana.
Yeah.
So the 9th mana isn't that big a
deal.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then when the times when you don't want a Path to Exile are like turn 3 or 4, because it's a much bigger difference to ramp them, you know, an extra turn ahead in mana on turn 2 or 3 than it is on turn 8 or 9. And most of the time in EDH, nobody's playing threatening 2 and 3 drops, so you're only Path to Exiling the 6, 7, 8, 9 casting cost stuff. So
Yeah.
So that extra land. Path to Exile is borderline better than Swords to Plowshares.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. But the fact that you can put both in your deck is great.
Yeah.
Not many cards are able to exile just like that. And that's what makes both these cards very powerful.
I actually have this much, well, not much higher, just 2 higher. I have it as number 2 on my list.
Nice.
Yeah, these are almost every deck with white will want both of these cards. Yeah. Almost. All right, my number four. Oh, this is gonna be a little bit of a controversial one.
I agree, though. I think this is a very powerful card.
Oh, this is one of the most powerful cards in the history, like objectively powerful cards in the history of Magic. It would have to be on the list in contention for the most, just pure power.
Pure power, card. Yeah. It's also just one of the greatest wipes.
It's also maybe the most hated card.
Oh, yeah. I bet people are already like, oh, I know exactly what they're going to say.
Yeah, it's Armageddon. Armageddon is 3 and a white for a sorcery. It's very simple. It says, destroy all lands. This is that card that people specifically point to as the card they hate the most in EDH. And I agree. I'm not condoning playing it necessarily. I actually only have it in a single deck. And that deck is the Nekusar deck. And that deck, if you get like a couple things set up and you Armageddon, you just win because they can't play cards.
Yeah.
But so they have to draw cards so they die. But people, I think what makes people mad about this card specifically is when people do it, but they don't have the effects to back it up. So what it does is it just sort of
wipes the board and it just makes
everybody sit there and draw cards and play lands again and do nothing.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not fun. It's more fun. It's okay, I think, if you play Armageddon and that is a win condition in your deck. Like that's causing you to win. It's not so much fun when you play it and that you don't have.
Yeah.
Well, I already said it.
If you play Armageddon and then you don't win within like 2 turns, then you're a bad person.
Yeah. I mean, at least you're not going to win in 2 turns. Yeah. I think if you play Armageddon and you would win, but then they go, oh, in response, I kill these 2 things. And then you're like, oh, crap.
It's like, sorry, everyone.
Yeah, but that's not my fault. That's a dude that killed the 2 things. You know, I was going to win.
Yeah, it's very hard to recover from Armageddon.
Yeah, because especially if you know you have it in your hand, you can do things like, oh, I'll just not play out my 12th, 13th, and 14th land.
Right, so you can
get I at least have 3 land in my hand. Because when I play Armageddon, everybody usually looks at their hand and they go, I got 1 land.
Yeah,
I would never keep this. I would mulligan this hand if we were starting the game over.
Everyone with the Gilded Lotus feels a little better, though.
Yeah, Soul Rings, Gilded Lotus. Yeah. And again, if you have Armageddon in your deck, you have more mana rocks than they do.
I think the best way to play this card is to float all the mana in one of your main phases, and then play Armageddon and hopefully have enough past that to, you know, get to whatever you need to do to win the game.
Yeah, or you have Gilded... Yeah, it does suck when somebody's just... That's their plan. They're like, I'm an Armageddon, and I have Gilded Lotus and Sol Ring. That's like, well...
Yeah, 5 mana?
So you're going to play a creature, we're all going to do nothing, then you're going to play another creature, attack somebody. Like, you're not going to ding somebody for 5 to the win, are you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but as far as just objectively powerful on its own, it does one of the most powerful things you can do in the game.
Mm-hmm. I feel bad. My number 3 is your number 1. I've stolen 2 of your picks so far. 3 of your picks.
Yeah, you're...
I've actually stolen all 3 of your top 3.
That's because your top 2 aren't even on my list.
I know,
so
that
you were
is
able
strange.
To bump every all my high stuff. Anyway, it's fine.
It's fine? Okay.
Let's just... Okay, let's
skip number 3.
Okay, we'll skip your number 3.
Because your number...
So we have some suspense and I have something to talk about.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so
I'll
talk about...
talk about your cards.
So Josh's number 3 is Lantax.
Actually, all the rest of my list have been on your list already.
Yeah, except for the... Yeah, there you go. So let's just move to my number 2.
Oh, yeah, my number 3 is Lantax, yeah.
And I don't know if this actually... Usually we try and keep the cards under $30. This might be the only one that goes above that.
Elishnorn might be above that.
Yeah, I think Elish might be right at the edge, actually. She might be like 27, yeah. My number 2 is Linvala, Keeper of Silence.
She's bonkers, and part of it's her casting cost.
Yeah, she costs 4 mana for a 3/4 legendary creature flying. Oh my god, she can make her a general. That's mean.
Yeah, I've seen Linvala decks.
Activated abilities of creatures your opponents control can't be activated.
Yeah, she's 2 and a white.
Yeah, that's...
3/4 flyer, that's great anyway.
Yeah, so 4 mana total for that effect on
She shuts off... Like all utility creatures, not all, but it's just activated stuff. Think of my Tim deck. Can't do anything.
Yeah.
Just done.
Think of Kiki Jiki.
Yeah. Done.
Yeah. There's triggered abilities still work, but like they're, I mean, I think activated abilities are much more often on card text than triggered abilities.
Yeah. Triggered abilities, I don't know. They're both, but just shutting off so many and it's just triggered abilities, creatures your opponents control.
Yeah.
Doesn't even have the downside of shutting off your stuff. It's super powerful. She comes out very early.
Yeah. Your Honorable Mentions has a similar card to this.
Yeah.
That costs a little bit more. But yeah, anything that can do... anything that can shut down everyone else's cards as your opponent's control, that's just... Like, it already makes the tech higher just because it can do that. And the fact that you can play this so early really, really makes her... I mean, you can play this on turn 2.
Yeah. She's super powerful. Yeah. Again, another card that in my honorable mentions, and she's in contention. I thought I had her on the list. I had her off the list. I had her on the list. The only reason I didn't put her on was because I didn't want to have too many creatures. Mm-hmm. So I decided, you know, three was about as many as I wanted. And I ranked her behind the other ones just because there are some decks where she doesn't do anything.
Right.
Where she's just a 3-4 flyer. There are definitely decks that don't have activated abilities at all.
Or at least aren't super reliant on them.
Like maybe they've got one or two cards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the
like
only
Like Lynn Vala comes down, but they're like, well, I still got my Prophet of Kruphix. So who cares, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it doesn't shut off Enter the Battlefield effects and things like that. So that's the only reason. I mean, don't get me wrong. Really powerful. Really powerful. That was my thinking when I didn't have her on the list, though. Okay, we're up to number one.
Well, your number two was... You know,
my number two, sorry, was Swords to Plowshares / Path to Exile. It's funny that we put them both together.
Yeah, they feel very similar.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, go ahead. I'll let you do your number
one. Oh, my number one? Okay, my number one is...
You. I'm my number one.
I'm my number one
guy.
Stoneforge Mystic. Good card. Just a really good card. Especially because I think most EDH decks want to find an equipment early. So she's one in the white for a 1/2 creature, Core Artificer. And when Stoneforge Mystic enters the battlefield, you may search your library for an equipment card, reveal it, put it into your hand, and then shuffle your library. And for one in the white, you can tap her. You may put an equipment card from your hand onto the battlefield. So not the equipment you necessarily search out.
But it can be.
But it can be. And with this, you can put out, like, what's that 6-drop that gives you
Battle
plus... you can put out a Battle Skull, which is a 5-drop for 2 mana. You can put out Argentum Armor for 2 mana.
Oh, man.
And just start wrecking face. So she essentially helps you cheat out stuff. So she does two things. One, she's a tutor. I mean, half the time I could just see getting Stoneforge. Half the time I can see you getting Swiftfoot Boots.
Yep.
Or Whisper Silk Cloak, Lightning Greaves, yeah.
One of those like staple ones. But you can get the huge broken stuff.
Yeah, she does two things. She tutors for a card, and then she cheats it into play, which are sort of the two of the most powerful things you can do in Commander.
Yep.
So
in Magic, period.
Stoneforge
Mystic wrecks in every format she's legal.
Yeah, yeah. You see decks being played with her, where she always just gets a Batterskull out. And if they don't get rid of the Stoneforge Mystic, then get ready to lose.
Yep.
So it's a really powerful card. Obviously, for me, it's my number one because I just... of course, if you're running a deck that doesn't have any equipment, then sure, she's not that great. But I think in general, you're always going to at least have 2 or 3 really good viable targets for her to get, and they're always going to be relevant.
Yep. She's super powerful. I don't have her on my list. Again, she was in the running. Mm-hmm. And it kind of shows like our different play styles, I think. Because I actually... Only just because for me, I don't actually have a lot of equipment in my decks. I usually have like Swiftfoot Boots, Lightning Greaves, and kind of that's it.
Yeah.
And some decks I don't have any of that because I have 3 decks that don't even play their commander ever.
Yeah.
You know, and the other like 8 or 9 decks, like only 2 of them are really what you'd call Voltron decks. And the rest are like, yeah, the commander's cool, but it's their ability I want. I don't actually need to buff them in any way, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of that's what it is. Like, because in a lot of decks, Stoneforge Mystic is broken. Like crazy.
Yeah. And like on turn 2, if you have a Soul Ring out turn 1, you could also just play the Swiftfoot Boots the turn that you fetch it with her.
Yep.
You know? So I think being 2 mana and all that, I think it's super relevant. But of course, like Josh said, if your deck doesn't rely on equipment, and that's totally fine. Like my Animar deck has 0 equipments in it, I think.
Right.
I think it might just have Lightning Greaves. Yeah. But well, she can't even play.
My number one, which was your number 3. And I'm glad we both picked the same card in this category. And this
card
I call the Wrath category. And,
yeah.
You know, that's another thing that is right in White's wheelhouse that they're sort of best at is...
big time Wraths.
Is Wraths, yeah. They were the original Wrath of God, which I debated. There was 3 I was debating between.
Mm-hmm.
It was Wrath of God, which is 2/2 white for destroy all creatures that can't be regenerated. There's Akroma's Vengeance, which destroys all artifacts, enchantments,
and you can cycle it too.
Yeah,
right?
it has cycling. Let me read it. Akroma's Vengeance, just so everybody knows. It's 4/2 white, destroy all artifacts, creatures, and enchantments. It also has cycling 3, which is pay 3, discard this card, and draw a card.
Yeah,
it's a sorcery. And then the
one that we both had as
the one that we both actually picked. Yeah,
the Big Daddy
is Terminus.
Ugh.
And Terminus is 4/2 white for a sorcery. It says, put all creatures on the bottom of their owner's libraries. But it also has Miracle for 1 white. And what Miracle if you can cast this card for its miracle cost, which is one white mana, when you draw it, if it's the first card you draw this turn.
Yep.
So you'll notice if you ever watch coverage of players, pro players almost always take the first card they draw, they put it to the side, like put it face down on the table, and then they flip that up by itself.
Yeah,
this is because of miracle. Because you need to be able to go, oh.
Yeah, because once it touches your hand, then you can no longer play it for its miracle cost because it can get lost in your sea of cards and
you
the cheating.
Cheat. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you have cards like this in your deck, you need to be careful, although most EDH playgroups are casual enough. Like ours, I don't think anybody would be like, you're cheating, Josh, because I've lost too many games. If I was cheating, I would win a lot more games. But the reason that this is powerful, potentially more powerful than those other two, and I think we both agree, is the bottom of your library is like this place where you don't want your cards in EDH, and you specifically don't want your commander down there.
Yeah, it's a bottomless, unhappy pit.
I mean, how many times have you played this? I've done this a bunch of times where I put all, you know, we're in a game of four people, and I'm just like, I got Terminus in my hand. I'm just waiting for the last guy to play as commander.
Yeah, and then you just Terminus.
I don't miracle it. I just six
for
mana.
Six mana, doing whatever. That is insane.
And it also has the added effect of getting rid of all the other creatures, but I don't even care about that. It's like, oh, all three of your commanders, bottom of your deck.
Tokens are just, they disappear.
Tokens are just gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is,
The miracle is just that icing on top, where like, because this is like great, right? Late game, let's say you're losing. You miracle this card, you are back in the running.
Yep.
Yeah.
Plus you can miracle it and play something huge.
Yeah, exactly.
Because one white is crazy for that effect.
Yeah. So Terminus, clearly an all-star in Commander.
The reason I had it number one, too, is because I find myself often in situations where I'm building a deck, and I'm like, oh, man, I wish I could play white in this deck because I need wraths.
Yeah.
And white has the most wraths.
And the best
ones. And this, I think, is the best of those. So I felt like...
It's not even like a real wrath either. It's a tuck, you know, for the most part.
Yeah. But it does... It destroys them. I mean, they're not in play and they don't have them in their hand, you know.
And it's very hard for them to get it back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's as if you were playing against a normal deck that just had more copies of those cards so they could potentially still get them later, draw them later, but...
I mean, this card's still good when you're winning, too, because you can just be like, okay, great, I got more gas in my hand, and like, they just put something else out that might take us towards parity. Like, let me just miracle this guy and start over on my board, and I'm fine
Wraths
with that.
Are great because you can craft the situation knowing you have the wrath.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I would normally play this, but I have a wrath, so I won't. And I'll just wait for everybody to play one extra creature, then I'll just get him.
Yep.
I'll get him.
I'll get him. You're my number one. Get them all.
So, okay, let's go through some of our honorable mentions.
Yes.
I'll go first.
Okay.
I had Luminarch Ascension.
Oh, yes. So this is a cycle of Ascension cards. Yep. And the way that these all work is that you can put quest counters on them. And there are different ways to do it. And once a certain number of quest counters are fulfilled, then the card has an extra ability, usually for some mana that does something pretty broken.
Yeah, and I think... Of the Ascensions, this is the best one.
There's
a couple other that are playable, but this one's crazy.
I think
powerful.
This is the best for EDH.
How cheap it is insane.
Yeah.
So, okay, it's one and a white for an enchantment. It says, at the beginning of each opponent's end step, if you didn't lose life this term, you may put a quest counter on Luminarch Ascension. So, if you play this on turn two, there's a good chance that in a multiplayer game that you have all the quest counters you need by the time the turn comes back around to you, because it's each opponent.
Yeah.
So... If I play it and then Jimmy doesn't attack me or do damage to me, then I get a quest counter. And then Craig doesn't do damage or attack me, I get a quest counter.
Yeah.
And then Alex doesn't do damage. And then it's like, so...
In one turn, you get three quest counters, essentially.
Correct. You can get more if there's more players, obviously. But yeah, so it's very easy. It's easier than in a normal game. You know, this was made for one-on-one where is somebody really going to go four turns? They're going to be able to do damage to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the kicker is for... It has a activated ability on it. It's for one and a white... colon, so you can do this as many times as you've got mana.
Oh my gosh.
Put a 4/4 white angel creature token with flying onto the battlefield. You can only activate this ability if you have four or more quest counters on it. Insanity.
A 4/4 white flyer.
For two mana.
Instant speed.
Many times as you want.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, this is one of those cards where the downside of the card is... Like I said earlier, I was saying like Blind Obedience doesn't actually cause... It does a lot.
Cause that much hate, yeah.
This card causes a ton of hate.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, hit that guy, hit him a lot. You have to, because you will just overwhelm the table.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't even board wipe. You're just like, okay, fine. Make seven more angels after you did that. Like, yeah, it's very, very powerful. So, and also white is one of the main token generating colors, maybe the main token generating color, and I felt really bad having my whole list and I didn't have a token generator on there.
Oh yeah.
So I had it at number 10 for a long time, but Blind Obedience is a pet card of mine.
Yep, there you go. So. And I had a lot more token generation, so we filled it out nicely. Yeah. One of my honorable mentions is a card that came out very recently. It's Hushwing Griff. And Josh hates this card, obviously.
But it is very powerful.
It's it does what Torpor Orb does, but it's on a creature that has flash. It's 2 and a white for a 2/1 flyer with flash, and creatures entering the battlefield don't cause abilities to trigger.
Shuts off all their entry.
Shuts off
the battlefield.
All that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And it's the flash is really underrated part of it because you basically counter the first one. They think they're going to get an effect because they're, I'm going to play this creature, I'm going to get an enter the battlefield, and you flash in Hushwing Griff.
Yep.
And then it's like, oh, you don't get that.
Yeah. So very, very powerful. Just a very good utility card. I think it's in the quote-unquote sideboard arena for, you know, if you have a lot of decks that have a lot of enter the battlefield effects. But I think in general, EDH players do use ETB effects a lot.
A lot. A lot. I would say, yeah, it can belong in the main deck of any sort of, you know, it's very good. It's like in a hate bear type of effect. Yeah, it's very cool. My next honorable mention is Austere Command.
Oh, I love this card.
Austere Command is 4 and 2 white for a sorcery. It's like it's in the cycle with Cryptic Command and the rest of them. It says choose 2.
That's so already good.
Yeah. Your options are destroy all artifacts, destroy all enchantments, destroy all creatures with converted mana cost 3 or less, or destroy all creatures with converted mana cost 4 or more. So you get to choose 2 of those.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, you could do the board wipe. You could 3 or less or 4 or more. That gets rid of every creature.
Right. Or if you look around and you're like, well, there's only creatures really 4 or more
that I care
about. And there's some artifacts I don't like, so I'll do those 2. Yeah. Or there's some enchantments I don't like, and the creatures are all small. I'll do those 2.
Yeah.
The versatility on the card is very powerful. Yeah. Also, white, again, within White's color pie is the ability to destroy artifacts and enchantments. Mm-hmm. So I felt like we needed to have a representation of a card that did that. The other one is Return to Dust.
Right. And that's a, it's not as,
it's
flexible as Austere Command.
But it's a little bit more efficient.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily. What Return to Dust is, in instance, 2 and 2 white, you exile target artifact or enchantment. But if you play it during your turn, your main phase, you can exile an additional artifact or enchantment. So basically it's rid of 2 things. You know, sometimes...
It's 4 mana as well, so it's a little cheaper.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's not 3 white.
And you can do it at instant speed, so if you have to play it on someone else's turn, obviously it's not ideal, but you can, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I prefer Austere Command to this card, but, you know, both of them were in the running. Yeah. Again, I just felt obligated to put... This is just something white does. This is destroy artifacts and enchantments, and, mm-hmm. and it's sort of the best at that. Green's also very good at it. Maybe it's not the best, but anyway.
One of my cards I put on here that... It isn't a cheap one, because it's old and it's busted. It's called Replenish. It's 3 and a white for a sorcery. Return all enchantment cards from your graveyard to the battlefield. I think that enchantments are the one thing that need to get removed in EDH. Otherwise, they will take over the game very quickly because there are so many enchantments that are just so crazy powerful that oftentimes you'll find that stuff gets off the battlefield more often than it stays there. Like if someone puts down like Doubling Season, you got to get rid of it.
Right.
So Replenish is just is just a great way to bring everything back at once. And even if it's just bringing one enchantment card, it's onto the battlefield. It's not bad. Not bad.
Oh, it's very, very powerful. The fact that it puts them onto the battlefield is really what puts this into the crazy.
Yeah.
Because you can be discarding stuff. You can be like putting it there knowing you have this in your hands.
Right. If you, yeah, if you can just, yeah, if you're drawing a ton of cards, be like, well, I'm just going to ditch all these guys and play Replenish.
Yep, exactly. So it cheats stuff into play. That's, yeah,
very
super
good.
Powerful.
Next up for me is Restoration Angel. 3 and a white for a 3/4 angel with flash and flying. When Resto Angel enters the battlefield, you may exile target non-angel creature you control, then return that card to the battlefield under your control. So it flickers a card.
At flash.
At flash speed. It's a ton of utility. It's also just a very powerful card. It's a 3/4
and
flash
flyer.
And
something to note about this card is that it returns that card to the battlefield under your control then.
Yeah.
It doesn't wait until the end step, which a lot of flicker cards do, which can be really powerful because if you have something like Acidic Slime, you kill something now. They don't get to like use it, attack with it, anything. You just go boom. And that is, I think, what puts Resto Angel into like a different, slightly different category than your average flicker.
Yeah. You can also, I mean, the nice thing is like you'd also tap your guys and attack with them or something, and then they're like, cool, I get a free swing at you, and then Resto Angel comes in, it bounces, it comes back.
Untapped,
yeah, and you can get some advantageous blocks out of that. Obviously, you want to trigger enter the battlefield effects with this. It's just very useful. I really like it. has a place, I think, in most decks if you can find a place for it, and if you have a lot of creatures that can abuse the end of the battlefield stuff. And it's tricky. I like being tricky.
I like it. My next one is Rest in Peace. In Peace is one and a white for an enchantment. It says, when Rest of Peace enters the battlefield, exile all cards from all graveyards. Sorry, BDM.
For two mana.
Yeah, sorry, Sidisi Dex. If a card or token would be put into a graveyard from anywhere, exile it instead.
Right.
So it clears all the graveyards and then basically says there's no such thing as a graveyard anymore.
Yeah. And that's the cool thing is because it's from anywhere. So someone mills a card off the top of their deck, discards from their hand.
Destroyed.
And there are a lot of cards that are like when a token or non-token creature dies or is put into the graveyard from play, like it just really hoses so many important cards. Like Academy Rector is one that we didn't talk about, but that card is also super powerful.
Yeah, so this is one of the best graveyard hate cards out there. So
yeah.
And it's two mana.
It's two mana.
And it's an enchantment. You can get it back with Replenish.
Oh, gosh. You can get a lot of things back with Replenish. That card is busted. Academy Rector is my next card. It's a 3 and a white for a 1/2. When Academy Rector is put into a graveyard from play, you may remove Academy Rector from the game, essentially exiling it. If you do, search your library for an enchantment card and put that card into play.
The into play part is what puts this into the obnoxiously powerful.
Yeah. You can put so much stuff into play with this card.
The worst is when somebody gets an Academy Rector out with you and then Voltrons it. And you're like, I don't want to kill it.
I don't want to kill it, but I have to.
But it's
otherwise.
Hitting me for 7. Yeah.
Yeah, not to mention just sack outlets. You can do stuff like there's a couple of like Pattern of Rebirth, so you get double triggers off of it.
Yep. Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, my last one is Iona, Shield of Emeria. And in the same game where the dude played Elishnorn on me,
he played this.
He played, Iona.
And you're playing a mono green deck, too.
I was playing my mono green Titania deck. I'm just going to let everybody out there guess how that turned out. It's a mean card. From a pure power perspective, maybe it belongs in the top 10. I don't know.
Maybe. It's expensive, though.
It is a little bit narrow sometimes.
But man, is it powerful.
I mean, he just happened to run into my only mono colored deck.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise I wouldn't even care. Okay, sorry. Iona, Shield of Emeria. She's 6 and 3 white, so 9 total for a legendary creature angel. She's a 7/7 flyer. As Iona, Shield of Emeria enters the battlefield, choose a color. Your opponents can't cast spells of the chosen color. So, right there, mono decks are just done.
Yeah.
Like, it's a win card. It just almost always will just win against a monocolored deck. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost always.
I mean, duplicate is like, you better hope they have a duplicate.
Or like a Memnarch deck is technically a mono blue deck, but yeah. But yeah, it just shuts off. And also, you can a lot of times look around and be like, oh, well, you all have blue. Also, just name blue.
Yeah, and you shut off a third of everyone's deck.
Yeah.
Or half of it.
It's just, the effect is very powerful. I actually don't have this in a single deck. I just know that it's super powerful. And maybe I was slanted because it just got played on me last night and literally destroyed me. But, you know, I don't think it's a particularly fun card. I wouldn't necessarily play it because it's just not the type of card. It reminds me of Blood Moon a little bit.
Yeah. It definitely doesn't really.
Where not only does it hurt them, but it also hurts their ability to deal with it.
Yeah.
That's what I don't like. You'd think I wouldn't like Armageddon because I don't like Blood Moon, but that's different. Armageddon, I can still play a land. Armageddon happens, and then it's done. It's not sitting there continuing to affect the board.
Right.
Whereas Blood Moon does something that then hurts my ability to destroy Blood Moon.
Yeah.
And that's what Iona can do.
Mm-hmm. Good call. I like Iona, though. She's a little too expensive. And
I don't like her at all.
If I have to put someone that's above 8 CMC, it would be Avacyn in the top 10 and not Iona.
9's a lot.
Yeah. The next card I'm going to talk about is kind of, it's still being tested. I don't think we know the full extent of it yet, but it's from Fate Reforged and it's Monastery Mentor.
I like having a new one on here.
Yeah, it's 2 and a white for a 2/2 human monk with prowess. So whenever you cast a non-creature spell, it gets +1/+1 till end of turn. Not that significant, but what is significant,
that's significant.
Whenever you cast a non-creature spell, put a 1/1 white monk creature token with prowess onto the battlefield. With prowess.
The token has prowess.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That is insane.
Yeah, this could be crazy. I don't know. I wish it was legendary so you could build around it.
It shouldn't be legendary. Oh my gosh. The deck that makes this card is just...
Yeah, it could. I think it's... I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But yeah. I think you could make it legendary and it would be on... look at Risk the Redeemed or something.
Yeah.
Like, he's just doubles the amount of tokens you have. So like, I don't know. Is this objectively more powerful than that? I don't think so. I think it's similar.
Sure. Yeah.
So...
It's a very powerful card, though. Yeah. It is insane. That's why all the Jeskai pre-releases, pre-release packs were gone. Because everyone wanted a foil Monastery Mentor.
Yeah. It's a very powerful card. It remains to be seen, I think, at this point, how powerful. Because do token decks play enough non-creature spells to make that a thing? I mean, they do, because there's a lot of spells that make tokens that are non-creature spells.
Is this better in the multicolored deck?
They usually cost so much mana that it's like, well, I don't know. Does getting one extra 1/1 every turn? I don't know. I don't know yet.
Yeah. It feels build-around-y, but at the same time, the power level is just... It feels very pushed.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like it is a powerful, powerful card.
The closest analog we have is like Young Pyromancer, which is better and worse in a lot of, in some ways. Like the tokens don't have prowess, but he costs one less. But that's not a huge EDH table. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is an interesting pick.
We will see. Yeah.
All right. So we have more honorable mentions. I think we're going to move on, because otherwise we're just going to talk about every white card that's ever been.
Yeah, and we'll put all of these on the podcast itself in the text box below, so you guys
and
can
we'd
check
love
the show
to
notes.
Hear your list in the comment section on Rocket Jump. Go ahead and make out your list of your top 10 white cards.
And there's been a lot of great contributions to the other ones that always bring up cards, and I'm like, oh right.
Well, it's been awesome for me. I don't know about for you, but, you know, on the red one artifacts one, like, I just look through everybody else's list, and I, you know, there's a few cards in there where you're like, I didn't even think about that card. Mm-hmm. That card is awesome.
Yep.
So, you know, it's good for us to sort of, you know, as we're hopefully illuminating new cards out to you, you can do the same to us, and everybody can have awesome cards that they can smash their friends with.
Yeah,
because that's definitely what it's about.
All right. Well, it's that time of the podcast where we get to announce some winners. I'm applauding for
really,
the winners.
Really quickly, the winners from last week,
didn't email us,
so we can't send out the prizes because we don't know who you are or where you live.
I put it in the mail, and I didn't put an address on it.
And you put like some username from the iTunes.
And it just got returned to me, so that was a bummer.
Please email us, and we're going to announce two winners this week, and you also need to email us. The email address is commandcast@rocketjump.com.
Yep.
So, and you can find that in the show notes. You can find that on the webpage on Rocket Jump. So again, you need to email us your name and your address if you want to receive your prizes. And I'm sure you do.
Yeah, there's some good prizes. We're talking Commander 2014. Well, actually, that's what you guys are winning this week.
Yeah.
So very exciting. So want to announce them?
Okay, go ahead.
Number one winner is Lucid Voltiel. I think I'm pronouncing that last part right?
Yeah, I think
Voltiel.
So.
Yeah. So congrats, Lucid. You just send us an email and you get some free stuff.
And winner number two is Vince Vindicated.
Very Vindicated. Don't play Vindicate on me, though, please.
Don't play Vindicate on my Iona. Or my Elishnorn.
Just don't play Vindicate.
Okay.
All right.
No, yes, play it.
Yeah, play it.
It's awesome. Card.
TIE Fighters. So congrats to Lucid Voltiel and Vince Vindicated. You guys are the winners for this week. Just send us an email with your name and your mailing address, and we will get your prize packs out to you ASAP.
ASAP.
As soon as possible. That's what it stands for.
All right, time for the end step, Jimmy.
All right, cleanup phase.
Do you have a cool thing you want to talk about? I do. I'll go first.
Okay, you go first. Yeah, I'll brainstorm and read it up.
Well, I just will talk about a cool book I've been reading recently. There's an author named Brandon Sanderson, who is a Magic player.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's actually the guy, if anybody read Wheel of Time, which was by Robert Jordan, it was a very big epic fantasy series, kind of Game of Thrones-y, before Game of Thrones was around. And Robert Jordan unfortunately died before the series was done. And Brandon Sanderson was the author that they tapped to finish the series, and that's how I became aware of him. And he has a series. It's called the Reckoners series. The first book is called Steelheart, which I really enjoyed. And his second
book... Sounds like a magic card.
Yeah. It's kind of this... The thing that Brandon Sanderson is known for, and I can't help but think it's influenced by his magic playing, is that his magic systems within his books are very well thought out. They have a lot... They're very well, like... You know the rules and how things work, and
right.
He works within the strategy of those rules of his magic system. So that's sort of like his stylistic. I don't know. It's one of his.
It's a well built universe.
Yeah, it's just something he's known for. So the new book is called Firefight, and I've been enjoying. But the first book in the series is called Steelheart. So I would definitely.
They both sound like magic card names. Yeah. It's great.
It's this universe where there's superheroes, kind of, but they're not heroes. They're all villains. Like, all these people been given superpowers, but the superpowers themselves sort of, like, warp the people. And so Yeah, so
that reminds me of BBC Four had a show that was like that, where they just gave superpower to these kids, and like they're just going to be reckless with them, obviously.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, but the people are that get the powers, it absolutely like they're like absolutely like evil. So
cool. All right, nice.
Yeah, so that's my one cool thing. How about you?
My one cool thing, I actually looked over and I saw it on my bookshelf. It's a new board game that I picked up over the holidays that my brother introduced me to. It's called For Sale. For Sale. Yeah.
Okay.
It's really, really simple. I think it's one of the best board games to play. They just teach people within like 5 minutes and everyone gets it.
That's really
important.
You
can play a game within 10 minutes. So no one feels like they're like, oh, here we go. 2 hours of the Game of Thrones board game or whatever. It's really simple. There are two phases. You start off with a set amount of money, and then you lay out these property cards that go from a value of 1 to 30. 30 is a space station, and 1 is a doghouse. So you get the
idea.
Oh,
man, I want a space station.
Yeah, exactly. And so you lay them out according to the number of players on the table, and everyone bids in order. You can only increase your bid to try and win, pay the least amount. You want to pay the least amount because you have like 6 rounds to get the best property. And the first person that says, I can't do it, I can't bid anymore, drops out. They take half of their bid back, and they take whatever is the lowest card on the table. So that goes around, and usually after one person drops out, someone else is like, well, they took the one, but there's a 12 there. That's pretty good. That's the next number, so I'll just take that and pay this small amount for it. And you do that 6 times until you have a nice hand of, you know, 5 or 6 property cards. And then you go to the second phase where you pull out money cards, and you try and sell your properties. And the way you do that is you lay out the money cards from $15,000 to $0. And you put a card out, and everyone flips their properties at the same time, and you just line them up. So if you put a 30 out, and everyone else is under you, then you get the $15,000, the highest money, essentially, and everyone goes down sequentially from that. So it's all about bluffing. It's a lot about sort of figuring out, like, I bet everyone's going to waste their high cards here, so I'm just going to pop out my lowest card and get a pretty good value for, you know, like a doghouse. I got $3,000. Like, that's amazing, or whatever. And by the end, you just tally up how much money you have, and that's the game.
Pretty cool. Sounds fun.
Pretty simple. Yeah,
I want to play.
Yeah, we can. It is very fast to do, and it's a lot deeper than you would imagine for being such a simple game.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Well, those are our cool things.
Those are cool things. Prize winners from last week. Make sure you email us. We want to give you your stuff. And this week, of course.
Yeah.
And until next time, I look forward to reading your top 10 winners.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Peace.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.
Hey, I'm Nolan Sykes, a host of Past Gas, the number one automotive podcast in the world. Every week, my co-hosts, James Pumphrey, Joe Weber, and I bring you some of our favorite stories from the hallowed halls of car history. From the amazing, to the weird, to the utterly unforgettable moments, we cover it all. Join us as we take a look at the wild stories and larger-than-life characters behind legendary cars and car makers. So if you love cars or just like a good story, check out Past Gas by Donut Media, the number one automotive podcast in the world.